This is the first interview with Laura Seiler on 10-17-73. Laura Seiler's name was given to me by Jesse Hafer Butler. She lives in a suite in a retirement community in Claremont. At the time I visited her, she had only been moved into this new living situation for 2 weeks. She is very active, alert, articulate, and quite well-spoken. She had quite obviously prepared herself for the interview following some letters between us, and had even thought of the various stories she might want to relate. Laura Seiler was quite involved in Harriet Stanton Blatch's Women's Political Union, beginning with her graduation from Cornell. Prior to that, she had formed a suffrage club in Cornell and relates a story about a debate. Her suffrage work, as she describes, is compressed into a very brief time span, essentially from 1913 or possibly 1912, beginning with the parade, until 1917. She did do more work during the final ratification drive in New York State, but after 1917, she devoted her life to her career in advertising. The interview gives some details of her background, but focuses primarily on the suffrage activity. A further interview to acquire a better understanding of her attitudes might be important.
Is get a general idea of your background.
It does in business.
Well, and that's the other thing, you see, which is I'm covering women in several different areas. Women.
In the New York agencies, which represent, I think, the biggest ones in the country, in my time, there were only three of us who got to be on the board of directors.
So that part of your history will be very interesting to us, too. So maybe what we could do today is this sort of, if you can give me a just broad outline, first your background, a little bit about your parents and the town in which you grew up and your education, and then how you got into the suffrage movement. Just sort of
that's very simple for me because it was a very logical transition. Now where do you want me to begin?
Wherever it's easiest for you, probably beginning with a little bit of information on your parents.
Well, all of my ancestors, so far as I know, and we have genealogies on them, were in America before 1700. So it's a straight New England background until the generation in which I was born, and I always have thought of them as New Englanders in exile because it seemed to me they bore down more heavily on New England traditions than if they'd been still living in New England. I grew up in Ithaca, New York, in my grandfather's house, and went to Cornell University. I was the youngest of three children, my elder sister, who was 7 years older than I, and my brother, who was 5 years older, also went to Cornell. My father had been a Cornell man, and it was a family joke with us that grandfather, who had had a period of retirement because of a breakdown in health, when he decided where to settle and practice law again, decided on Ithaca because at that moment they had just opened a college and he had four daughters. So it was a family joke that that was why he had moved to Ithaca to marry them off.
Now, did the daughters all attend Cornell?
No, none of them. One of them married a Cornell man, two of them married Cornell men, and one of them didn't marry. Her sister having married the man that she was in love with. And the other one, trying to think, she married an Ithaca man, but not a Cornell man. So, we all went to the university, and I took an arts course, as my sister had done. My brother was both an engineer and a naval architect. And I got a high beta kappa for reasons, great surprise to me, since I had not concentrated on high marks especially, and was vastly surprised. You know, one of my professors meeting me coming up the hill one day, I expressed surprise, and he said, well, it was kind of a relief to be able to vote for somebody who hadn't always had her nose in a book. So...
what year did you start at Cornell?
Now I have to count backward. It must have been 10. It must have been in 1910. I graduated in class of 1913. And I had had to wait a year after high school because in those days Cornell let men in at 16, but women not till 17. So I had a year to kill, and I went to Panama where they were building the canal and spent the winter down there with my grandmother. My father was the estimator for the buildings that they built down there. He was an architect. So that's the beginning, and in 1912 I started the suffrage club at Cornell, and it was a very natural thing for me to be interested in suffrage because one of my sister's classmates was the daughter of Harriet Stanton Blatch, and Nora was in our house a good deal. My sister was enormously interested. And my sister graduated in 1908 and went to New York and was the vice president of the Women's Political Union, which was, I think, the most militant of the national organizations. So that, of course, I took time off, went down and marched in the suffrage parade at my sister's behest.
Was that the 1913 parade?
I'm not quite sure. I would have thought it was 1912, but I'm not perfectly certain. Yeah, oh, it must have been, because I don't remember going to New York just before graduation. I think it must have been the 1912. At any rate, Inez Milholland led it, looking very beautiful. And there were both jeers and cheers from the sidewalk.
Did you march in a Cornell contingent?
No, I don't... As far as I know, probably with the Women's Political Union. No, there were not very many people interested in suffrage at Cornell at the time I started the club. And it led to a very amusing affair. One of the students came over to see me one day to say that his mother, who was a prominent anti-suffragist, was coming to visit him. And would I like to arrange a debate while she was there? And I was entitled to ask for one of the big auditoriums set aside, and so I said, yes, I would. But I didn't think it was suitable for a person of my age to debate his mother, so I consulted the head of the women's club in Ithaca, who was the wife of an instructor. And she was a very earnest woman. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
She agreed to debate, and she was a very earnest young woman. But not a skilled debater. And the woman who came from New York was a very grand dame indeed, with all the polished manners to go with debating. So that sitting up on the platform as chairman, I became congealed with horror, because what was developing was a hair-pulling performance, setting the audience into fits of laughter. The woman from New York would say, well, now my esteemed opponent has said so-and-so. And the other woman, who was by then furious at the customary misleading statements that anti-suffragists specialized in, would say, what she says is not so, or that's a lie. And I, of course, grew perfectly frantic, realizing that that audience, many of which were townspeople as well as students, were going out, going to laugh their heads off, and certainly it was doing good to suffer no good. I also knew chairman was supposed to keep their mouths shut, but I was a suffragist, and I wasn't going to let this go down the river. So I rose up at the end and thanked both of them, and then proceeded, rather crisply, I think, in about 5 minutes, to point out to them the difference between personality and causes, and that they could leave either confirmed in reaction with the anti-suffragists or planning to go ahead with suffragists. And as sometimes happens in those circumstances, I was so convinced that I was right that I felt about 8 feet tall, and I think I never spoke better, with the result that I got an ovation at the end. And it did result in more people joining our suffrage organization among the women students, and altogether it turned out well in the end, except that I received a letter of reprimand from my sister, who said, "Well, I hope you realize now that all you did was to furnish an audience and a platform for an anti-suffragist." But I continued to believe people should hear both sides of the story, in spite of my sister. It may not have been good maneuvering, but I felt it was the honest way to do it. So then, when I graduated, they decided that it would be a very good thing for me to go and organize, as they then called it, the two counties of Chautauqua and Cattaraugus in New York State. And my mother, who was not a confirmed suffragist, but a very charming Victorian, went along to chaperone me. And I was supposed, I had a little list given me of people that were thought to be sympathizers, and I was supposed to go in and organize them and leave a unit behind to go on working, and also take up collections and make street speeches. And ahead of time, I had to send them a little publicity, telling them what it was going to be all about. When I got there, I had to contact all these women and get them organized. And then I had to make a street speech. And that was in the days when you could still rent cars where the back went down. So we would rent a car and put an enormous banner across the back of it, letting it down. Then I would stand up on the back seat and make the speech. And of course, the most difficult moment for a street speaker is getting the crowd. And as in all small towns, the most, well, how shall I put it, the most sought-after corner of the street was the one which held the bar. So I always directed the chauffeur to stop just outside the bar. And my mother, who, as I said, was small and charming and utterly Victorian and convinced that all good things started with the favor of the male, would go through the swinging doors and say, "Gentlemen, my daughter is about to talk about suffrage outside, and I think you would be interested. I hope you'll come out." And just like the Pied Piper, they would all dump their drinks on the bar and come out and make the nucleus of the crowd, you see, and then we would be going. And then I was always embarrassed at having to take up a collection. I was convinced they thought we put it in our own pockets. But mother had no such qualms. She would circulate about giving out the pamphlets and holding out this thing and saying, "I'm sure you want to help the cause," and the folding money would come in. She was invaluable.
Did she become a believer, or was
still? Oh, confused? Well, as long as her daughters believed in it. But she never did any work for suffrage that I recall. She did a lot for the Red Cross, but I don't recall her working for suffrage.
What was usually the argument that you would give in your speeches?
Well, that varied a little according to the type of town. But in general, it was the injustice of it, and the fact also that the injustice affected men indirectly, that it held down the wages of all of them, that women were underpaid. And once in a small town, I had a very amusing experience. We were the guests in the house of a man who owned a factory, a very charming young man, his wife, delightful people. And I made a speech, and in the course of it, I reminded them that the only way that men had been able, really, to affect their wages and conditions and so forth was getting together into unions and bringing pressure to bear, upon which a ripple of laughter swept over the crowd, and I couldn't imagine why. like up back to my host's home, and he told me that he had spent all last year fighting their efforts to form a union. So here I was under his auspices advising them to go. Well, things like that happened. And we also, of course, there were still dreadful conditions in factories in those days, and we bore down on things of that sort. Child labor was by no means unheard of any more than it is today. All sorts of arguments, depending a good deal on the audience and on the woman who was making the speech.
So it was a broader position than the suffrage position then. Many of the suffragists would focus only on the votes and the injustice of the votes and wouldn't deal with other social issues.
Oh, no. At least my feeling is that most of us focused on the importance of the vote to change social conditions.
Did you call yourself a feminist then, or you used the
No, word? I never thought of myself as a feminist. In fact, all my life, I have, until I was retired to these places, have I had more men friends than men, partly because of my choice of business. And I always got on extremely well with them, and I have, whether truly or not, ascribed that to the fact that I grew up in my grandfather's house. My mother had left my father when I was about 6 months old, and I never laid an eye on him until I was about eight. So that there was never any, my grandfather was elderly then, there was never any question of a dominating male. And consequently, I grew up with absolutely no feeling of ever having been put down, as it were, by a male, and I never have felt that way. Consequently, I don't have any of the bitterness that many women, I'm sorry to say, in women's lib have.
You associated the label feminist with a rather bitter anti-male feeling then?
I think I did, in spite of the fact that my sister was very popular also with boys. But I really never thought of it. In college, I discovered very early that if you danced well and skated well, and I was a fancy skater and played tennis and did such things, that boys were also very pleased to discover you could think. I never was brought up to feel that you had to pretend to be an imbecile to be attractive. And I always got the kind of response that I expected. And the same thing was true in business. I can only remember twice when there was an attempt called Put Me Down. And one of them, oddly enough, came about in a very curious way. I had become a little distressed at how rapidly the things we learned in college became obsolete. And I wrote up to the president of Cornell and suggested that perhaps when 25-year reunions came around, that it might be a very good idea to set aside at least a day and arrange for the heads of departments, particularly scientific departments, in which the changes had been greatest, so that the alumni could come and be brought up to date. They would say, well, this is what you were taught in physics when you were in college. This is what we think now. Well, he thought it was a good idea, and he wrote down to the man who was the chairman of the 25-year reunion of men that year, and he came to call on me, and he listened in a rather supercilious way to this idea. And when he was all through, he said, where did you get the idea? I said, the same place where most of my ideas come from, out of my own head. Good evening. I was enraged with him. That is one of the few times that I can remember. Otherwise, I have always found men very open and willing to meet you on your own ground.
So you would have... You did call yourself a suffragist.
Oh, yes. Everybody called us suffragettes in those days.
Did they use the word suffragette or suffragist?
Well, I don't remember specifically being called a suffragette. I would say a suffragist is what we spoke of ourselves as. It was mostly the newspapers, I think, so forth, who called us suffragettes.
Was that an attempt to put
suffragists
down, you think?
Mm-hmm, I think so, yeah. Now, when I speak of the Women's Political Union as the most militant, I have in mind that we believed much more in demonstrations, in street speaking, and in things of that kind, that I remember as being characteristic of the other organizations. For instance, we spoke on street corners every night in the week, and I remember the little soapboxes with candles on them, which every suffragette carried out and plunked down on the curbstone. We had to have permit from the police department for speaking. Now, the others may have done a lot of it, but if so, I wasn't conscious of it. They mostly spoke in halls and so forth and so on, but we believed that you had to get to the people who weren't in the least interested in suffrage. That was the whole theory.
Now, how many of you would go on to the street corner when you spoke?
Oh, well, of course, we had, it depended. We had really a lot of volunteers. I would say there must have been at least, out of our office, 10 or 12 speaking on street corners every night.
Now, where was the office located? Was this
The office that I remember best, and I think it was there all the time, was in just off Fifth Avenue on 42nd Street, almost opposite the library.
Well, you went to New York City following these tours that you made with the car, is that it?
Yes, and I was the head of their speakers bureau for quite a long time. I had had training in New York in public speaking.
What sort of, in these small towns, when you traveled around in the chauffeured car and spoke, what sorts of reactions?
Well, we didn't travel in chauffeured cars. We didn't have that kind of money. We rented a car in each place.
Oh, specifically for the purpose of what sort of reactions did you get from your audience?
In general, how much was due to my good mother, I don't know, but I remember considerable enthusiasm and also a great deal of good-natured tolerance on the part of the men, and as I say, rather good collections.
Did you pass around petitions? Were there signatures after the talk?
No. I don't recall any petitions. We gave them out always a good many pamphlets of one kind or another.
Was the audience primarily men?
In the evening, you see. This would be in the evening after dinner that we made these speeches in order to catch the men off work. And they would be mostly men. In towns, and that was true in most of the small towns, where I had a name perhaps of three or four women who were thought to be sympathetic, they would have a house meeting then for the purpose of forming a group, and I would talk to the women about it and provide them with the materials and tell them how to organize and so forth. After I left the town, of course I had to send back a publicity for the local paper. And we got really a lot of it. They were delighted. Of course, they clipped them all and kept them in the central office in New York. And some of those women that I organized went on into quite extensive suffragist experiences. One of them, I remember, somewhat to my dismay, I discovered, had joined Alice Paul's group and was hunger striking in Washington. And I'm quite sure that that kind of campaigning did a lot of good, because we reached people, I'm sure, who were not in the least interested in suffrage up to that moment.
What was the age of most of the women in these small towns that you would attempt to pull together into a suffrage group?
My recollection is mostly not so young, married. I would say perhaps women in their late 30s, middle 40s.
That's what I...
Yeah, it is. I thought it was a very interesting idea for a project. And I must say that I looked at the program on which Jessie appeared, and she came and practiced on me beforehand, and I confess I told her to leave out a great many things she was planning to do, because I said, I have an idea, you're only going to have a minute or so remembering those programs. And sure enough, and ridiculously I thought, considering it was supposed to be celebrating the 50th anniversary, all the other speakers were talking about what women were doing today, which had very little to do with the case. On the other hand, I assume that the TV station felt that women would probably be vastly uninterested in what the suffragists had been up to.
Well, I'm going.
Yes, she did very well. It's quite typical of Jessie, I may say.
Well, how long did you spend in this campaign going to these small towns?
All summer. I got back to New York, I think, probably around the 1st of September. In other words, as soon as I got my degree, I was the last mother waited till I was through school. The others were already in New York. And we went immediately and started on them. I think we spent probably about 6 weeks in each county.
Hmm.
And that made it about September when we got back to New York.
What was your intention on graduation? Did you plan a career?
Well, I would have had to as a sister of my sister, who definitely believed in careers for women. I didn't have any very special idea. I was engaged. I was married following October in New York. I got there. And I hadn't given too much thought about it. When I went up to Cornell at request a few years later to talk to the graduating class about the advertising business, the dean of women met me with a smile and said, "Laura, do you remember what you wrote down when you came in as a freshman, what you were going to do?" She said, "You wrote down that you were going to teach." And the next question was, "Why?" And you said, "Because they had such long vacations." Well, I had forgotten that idea by the time I finished college. And when I got to New York, as I say, I was the head of the Speakers Bureau for several months. And Mrs. Blatch, who was the president, was a singularly dictatorial and arbitrary woman. Very clever, very devoted, but also quite difficult. And I violently disapproved of some of her policies, considering that we were a women's organization. I felt we should be especially fair in our treatment of employees and so forth. So at any rate, I said to my sister that I wanted to get out and start something. And a friend of hers, who I think had her own printing business, said, "Well, she's done so much writing, I think she'd be good at advertising copy." And I didn't even know what advertising copy was. They had to explain to me it was the text of the ads. So she gave me a list of agencies, and I called on some of them, and I presume I looked exactly like Sis Hopkins, fresh down from the country. And none of them were at all impressed. The agencies said, well, they preferred people who'd had retail experience, women, that is. And then I tried some of the department stores. No, they didn't have time to bother training anybody like that. So by then I got quite annoyed. And the only store that I hadn't called on was Macy's. So I went in and demanded to see the advertising manager and told him about my experience trying to get a job in agencies and the other stores. And I said, "Now, I will come to work for you for $10 a week for 2 weeks. And at the end of that time, both you and I ought to know whether I can write advertising copy." And he was so flabbergasted that he hired me. And at the end of 2 weeks, they were running the copy the way it was written, so then it became a real job.
This was, what, about 1914 then?
Mm-hmm.
Well, exactly. When you were with the Women's Political Union, you were actually, as head of the Speaker Bureau, you were actually a paid employee?
Oh, no. I don't recall that I was paid anything. I may have been. Small sum. I don't recall that. But I was living with my mother and sister, and I don't remember that. I very likely must have been.
And is that, you were doing only that at that time?
Yes, that's all. No. I was training speakers and giving them their assignments and doing a lot of speaking myself.
How many speakers were there?
Well, of course, they were on a voluntary basis, and some did much more speaking than others. We did have, especially at campaign times, a certain number of women who were taken on and paid small sums, probably just enough to cover their expenses. But that was never a very great item. You were supposed to be giving your time and yourself as much as you could afford to. The secretaries, of course, were paid like anybody else. But most of the work was really done by volunteers.
So again, most of the women were probably in their late 30s or early
40s. Some of them were older. Mm-hmm. We had a large roster of very famous women who came in and stuffed envelopes and did things of that kind.
Was there any feeling of competition with the other more conservative
mm-hmm.
suffrage groups?
They often didn't agree on tactics. The Women's Political Union was Mrs. Blatch, I may say, was married to an Englishman, and I don't know whether she had lived a long time in England or not, but at any rate, we as a society were much closer to the English group than any of the others. I think there was a general feeling among, I've forgotten the exact title of Mrs. O.H.P. Belmont, who's, I think it was the Woman Suffrage Organization, something like that, and Mrs. Katz, of course, was the national organization. I think there was a feeling that the things that the women were doing in England were rather outrageous and they wanted no part of them. Whereas Mrs. Blatch felt, which accounts in part for the name of the organization, the Women's Political Union, that the only way that they were ever really going to get anywhere was to exert political pressure. And consequently, there were very friendly relations with the Pankhursts and with many other people. And Mrs. Pankhurst came, I know, and addressed a large dinner meeting. And Sylvia Pankhurst came over and also spoke. And I think we raised some money for them at one time or another. Beata Forbes Robertson was here, and people like that. And they were a much more radically oriented group, I would say, than the Americans ever were. We did no chaining of ourselves to lampposts and things. The nearest approach to it, of course, was Alice Paul in Washington with her hunger strikers and so forth. And there's no doubt about it that that is what precipitated the president's decision to bring the matter before Congress. I'm very sure if Alice Paul had not carried on those demonstrations, it would have gone on years more before it ever got to the Congress. So I think one should give her due credit.
What was the reaction of the Women's Political Union when Alice Paul formed the National Women's Party?
Well, I think many of them, we had, of course, as you'd expect, a mixture of conservatives and more radical ones. And I think there was a general feeling that she was going a little far. That wasn't true of all of them, and there was a great deal of sympathy for what she was trying to do, but I think there was a good deal of skepticism as to the wisdom of some of the things that she did.
Because I have read accounts which vary in terms of... I know Harriet Stanton Blatch said in one place that she was responsible for bringing Mills and tactics to the United States, but mm-hmm. Alice Paul was really the one to whom that was attributed for the most part.
Well, I think that is true, because certainly Mrs. Blatch was working on these things long before Alice Paul came into the picture at all. But I think she carried them to the ultimate, mm-hmm. went far beyond anything that Mrs. Blatch would have suggested herself, at least that's my impression.
Was there a very clear separation between the groups? For instance, were there women involved in your group who might also be involved?
I don't think so. The tactics were quite different and the leadership was very different. And I'd be surprised if there were. There may have been some who grew disgruntled with one group and went into another. That's quite possible. But I don't ever remember women that worked for two at once.
Hmm. Now, were there other... You say that there were other causes which most of the women in the Women's Political Union espoused. For instance, unions.
Yes, and of course they didn't all agree about that either. And they were all, of course, very interested in the remnants of child labor, which still existed. And you may recall that was the period of the horrible shirtwaist mm-hmm. fire and all that sort of thing. Well, there were plenty of abuses. I remember when I visited my sister once for a summer vacation before I was through college, she got me a press card with the old morning, forgotten now, it was the Sporting paper. And he sent me on assignments, one of which was the Hobo's Convention, at which Debs was supposed to appear and didn't, because I think he was at that moment in jail. But not Emma Goldman, but the man with whom she was associated.
Alexander Berkman?
No, the other one, Will Hayward, came to the convention and spoke in place of Deb and so forth, and there were lots of reporters there, and we all held a little spoofy meeting when we discovered we were not going to have Mr. Deb, and the reporters made speeches, and they asked Sis Hopkins, which was me, to make one, and we all wrote that up for the papers. And I remember that the Morning Telegraph, that was its name, read, published two versions of this, one by the man and one by the woman, side by side. Well, what really reminded me of that was that, among other things, he told me for my own education to visit the night court, the women's night court, which I did, and I was quite horrified at what seemed to me the disregard of women's feelings and rights. I remember one especially, was the trial of a prostitute, and no doubt she was a prostitute, but her lawyer said something about it was her word against the policeman. There were no witnesses. And the judge said pontifically, the word of an officer needs no corroboration. And I was enraged. It's the one thing that I remember clearly out of that assignment. And that was, of course, in general, women were viewed as second-class citizens. There were no two ways about it. Their advice was not taken as seriously, and their opinions were not given the same weight as those of men. I don't think anybody argues about that anymore. It's still true, as far as that goes.
Was there a connection between your group and, for instance, the Women's Self-Supporting League, or the Women's Trade Union League that was attempting to bridge the span between women in industry and suffrage?
Well, we had a very marvelous woman, her name was Kelly. What was the rest of her name? You would know it in a minute if I could think of it.
Oh, Florence Kelly?
Florence Kelly. Was on the board, as I recall it, and a very fine person. And as I remember it, she was especially interested in the trade union movement for women.
Yeah.
I also remember doing a brochure for them. And I had carefully dug out the library, all the instances, you see, where women were discriminated against and put them down. When the pamphlet came out, Florence Kelly sent for me. And she said, I wonder if you have any idea how really unfair this pamphlet is. It's all there in black and white. Yes, she said, but so often there are the balancing laws against these. She said, I made some reference to... Well, at any rate, I remember her saying to me, yes, but in addition to the dower rights, there are the things called the courtesy rights, which help to offset these. And she said, that's true in all statements, true of all statements you've made. I was crushed. What I had said was true, but it was not true in the sense of the whole truth. And I think she impressed that on me forevermore. She was a quite marvelous person. And there were others like... Dr. Anna Shaw, who were outstanding, just as people.
Was she fairly active in the group?
Dr. Anna, I'm not at all sure that she belonged to the Women's Political Union or whether she sort of stood outside of all the organizations. She spoke for us very, very often, and she may well have been, but that I don't remember. I think of her as a national suffragist figure.
No, she seems to have been quite often associated with Carrie Chapman Catt.
Yes, I think she was. She stands in my mind as a little group of very fine and prominent women who lent their support to suffrage, but I don't associate her with any special group.
Now, when you were coordinating the Speakers Bureau, this was not just of women who went out onto the street and were speaking in soapboxes. These would also be gathering...
Oh, yes. All kinds of things. One that I remember was very funny. A very tiny little man in very shabby clothes, a clergyman from a parish somewhere out in the wilds of Long Island, came in one day and asked for a speaker, the evening meeting. And he went to Mrs. Blatch, and Mrs. Blatch brought him out to me, and I had already assigned all my speakers for that evening, so I said I'd have to do it myself. My family was not exactly charmed with my taking these evening meetings, but I did when I had to. And he was inclined to be a little He said, well, I think maybe an older and more experienced woman. And Mrs. Black sat down hard on him and said, Laura's one of our most experienced speakers, and went back into her office. So he was a little crushed, but he began to explain to me how I had to get there. I had to change buses twice, so forth. And also that his wife was in a wheelchair. She'd been in an accident, but she was very anxious to have me come out for supper. So I went. And it was quite an experience. They sent me upstairs to wash my hands, and the bathtub was full of goldfish. They had two little boys. The little boys had the upper part of the house, you see. And when I came back downstairs, they were standing at the foot of the stairs, grinning, and their father said to me, they wanted me to tell you that on Saturday nights they take the fish out and take their baths. So then we went over to the church, and there were a small group of women. His wife was a very ardent suffragist, and she had started this little group over there. And the first thing he did was to ask me to play the doxology. And I had never opened a suffrage meeting with doxology before, but I was lucky enough to be able to play it for them, so I did. And then the women clustered around afterward and told me all about this wife and so forth, and I said, how come the doxology? And they said, well, Mrs. whatever her name was, put more faith in God than in politicians. So there were lots of funny little things like that that went on too. It wasn't all difficult.
Now, you were married during a lot of this campaigning then?
Not during the 2 months after college. I was married the following October after I got back to New York.
So when you were in New York and coordinating the Speaker's Bureau that you were already married, mm-hmm. What was your husband's feeling about suffrage in your work?
Well, he was a very gentle and kind man, and he was really responsible for my first realization that I was a suffragist, because once when we were in college, early in the career, it was being discussed, and he said, oh, Laura doesn't believe in suffrage. And at that moment, of course, I knew I did. And the only time that I remember specifically upsetting him was that Nora Blatch and somebody else had made a riding trip through a couple of counties. They were always dreaming up stunts so they'd get some publicity, making speeches, you see, from horseback and so forth. And one morning, I was sitting in my office, and I came bursting in from Mrs. Blatch's office and said, you ride, don't you? And I said, well, I haven't ridden since I left school, but you do ride, and you have a riding helmet. Well, they said whatever the friend's name was is ill. And the horses are already ordered, and they're going to ride down to City Hall Park and make a speech, and you'll have to take her place. So you didn't argue in suffrage, you took orders. So I went home and put on my riding habit and came back. By the time I got back, the horses were dancing out in 42nd Street, very annoyed. And I climbed on, and they put big boards on the side of each horse announcing a meeting it was to be, and of course that didn't care. That hit them every time it moved, and all the sidewalks were lined with people shouting things at us, and the buses that went by, and the policemen were furious with us because we were glomming up traffic. And we got down to City Hall Park just at noontime, didn't calculate that way, and everybody came out from the offices, and Nora made a pretty proper speech from her horse. Mine was behaving very badly by then, and I began, ladies and gentlemen, bouncing up and down. They were English saddles, and I'd never ridden in anything but an army or a French saddle before. And then, just as I was launching into my speech, I glanced across the square, and there stood my astonished and astounded new husband. And at that very moment, a horrible little office boy jabbed a pin into my horse, and he reared, and I hung onto the front of this terrible English saddle and saw down the curb bit and finally got him down. But that was the end of my speech. We then took off back toward the office. But between all the excitement and the saddle sores from not having ridden in a long time, I was in bed for a day. It was a little difficult to explain why suffragists had to make fools of themselves.
So his reaction was primarily in terms of how foolish it was, rather than...
Well, just not caring to see his wife doing any such thing. Then, of course, we presently did another thing. They decided that it would be nice to hire a motorboat and run up and down the shoreline yelling suffrage votes for women at all the men who were loading cargoes and things. So I was assigned along with Nora to this job. And of course we always took reporters with us when we did things. And this time, the women reporters evidently rebelled. We knew two men, both of whom were definitely anti-suffrage and furious at the assignment. So of course we went in. The man who was hired with the motorboat evidently had not been told what we were going to do. And when we explained, he said, "Oh, geez, what are the men going to say to you?" And of course, that was perfectly true. As soon as the men began understanding that we were yelling votes for women at them, they made replies such as you might expect. And meantime, of course, all the boats went by. Everybody rushed to that side of the ferry boats, and the waves came and bounced us up and down. And the both reporters had, I remember, to bail us out with their hats. They were furious every minute. And when we finally got back, and Nora said to them, "Now, see through, give us a good write-up." And I looked all through the papers the next day. There was one tiny little paragraph in a column. So I met one of the reporters who said he'd always hated suffragists a few days later, and I said to him, "You certainly didn't do very well by us in way of publicity." He said, "Well, next time, just get yourselves drowned, and I promise you the first page."